Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. When Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren formed her presidential exploratory committee, and even before that, criticism rolled in. She's too progressive, too divisive. She botched that DNA test. But much of the scrutiny centers on one theme: likability. Hillary Clinton knows something about that. In fact, she cracked jokes about it at an event at the New York State Capitol just yesterday.
You know, there's been a lot of talk recently about whether our country is ready for women leaders. Now, that really takes me back. But today, I want to thank all of you for your persistence. I know many of you and can attest as to how smart, determined, effective, and dare I say, likable you all are.
But why does a woman have to be likable in politics in the first place? Well, here to chat about all of that is Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Hello, Ellen. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Also with us from the Boston Globe is Janae Osterholt. She's a cultural writer for the Globe. Hello, Janae.
Hi, thank you.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you on this as well. Should likability matter in politics? Are women punished in politics and in culture for not being likable enough? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Ellen, what do you make of these concerns about whether Elizabeth Warren is likable enough? Should that matter?
Well, I think the likability of any candidate obviously is a variable. Voters need to feel comfortable with whomever they choose as their candidate, and it's perfectly legitimate to have that be a variable in the decisions that a voter makes. The question is, how is one's likability determined or framed? And I think in contemporary presidential politics, so much of it is driven by media that the candidate themselves don't always have an easy time of establishing their likability before it's determined for them.
Well, part of Warren's effort to establish herself as likable may have been a live stream on New Year's Eve that's attracted a lot of attention. We'll play a little bit of it. This is Warren drinking a beer in her home, and the video was seen by some as inauthentic, perhaps pandering. Take a listen.
Hold on a sec. I'm going to get me a beer. Hey, Robert, my husband Bruce is now in here. You want a beer?
So, Janae, you wrote about this. You wrote that perhaps our need to define a woman by how cool or nice or pleasant they are is why Warren felt the need to chug a beer on Instagram in the first place. So what do you think was going on there? What are the dynamics at play?
It's just I agree that likability is important, but only if we're playing by the same definitions, which is, you know, if we're talking about political candidate, that's diplomacy and working well with others. But I feel like as applied to women, it's about coolness and niceness, and if their voice is a certain tone, or if how they hold their face. And with that, with her chugging a beer, even she said it was like a way to invite people into her home, an everyday person. And I think there was this attempt to like humanize her, which is crazy because she's already a human. She's already she doesn't need to do that. And but it's like we have made it this way. Like, how can she be more likable? You know, there's people who don't like her voice, they don't like her face, they don't like her clothes. None of that has anything to do with diplomacy or her skills or her talent. There's plenty of things we can talk about legitimately as far as her capabilities, but this whole idea of is she the girl you want to hang out with is ridiculous, and it's only something that I see happening to women.
So the standards of likability can be different. The things that some people like about their candidates will be turnoffs for others, obviously. You know, for example, Elizabeth Warren has really sort of leaned into some of this. She's been able to fundraise off of and create some merchandise around that nevertheless she persisted remark from Senator Mitch McConnell last year. So that's one way to answer it. And yet I get the sense, Ellen, that it's more of a drag. You know, while you may be able to fundraise some money off of this and make it kind of a rallying cry, that on the whole, this kind of scrutiny of a candidate's likability is more problematic than help.
Well, I think the problem is that our standards of what is likable, or the sort of prevailing conversation about that, has been largely determined by male candidates. So that if the standard is this somebody who you want to go out and have a beer with, as opposed to a glass of white wine, let's say, it's a hard test, I think, for most women to come across as likable in that way. It was said about George W. Bush that he was a likable guy. Maybe he didn't like his politics, but he came across as, you know, sort of down to earth, and that appealed to some voters. And so the difficulty is when the gender question gets into the mix, as it will whenever there's a woman presidential candidate, how is likability determined and how do the candidates try to play to that?
You know, the Bush example is a good one because just yesterday we saw Joy Behar on The View suggesting that perhaps Warren was making a joke and making a reference to that, you know, George W. Bush, he's the guy you want to have a beer with thing, and maybe that's what she was trying to get at.
Right.
You know, was sort of poke fun at this standard. That's,
I wish I thought it was sardonic, but unfortunately, it seems as if it wasn't.
All right. So listeners, once again, you can chime into this conversation as well. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Lizzie is calling in from Lexington. Lizzie, what's on your mind? Nope, we don't have Lizzie now. Sorry. So I'm going to go back to Janae. My question to you, Janae, right now is how this sort of expands beyond politics as well, because you write not only about the context of Elizabeth Warren, but also a recent episode involving the comedian Tiffany Haddish. Remind us what was going on with her around New Year's weekend as well.
Tiffany Haddish failed. She just flopped. Comedians, all famous comedians have done it, from Richard Pryor to Dave Chappelle. I mean, she had a bad night, and even in the middle of it, she told the crowd, like, I'm failing, this is going to be on TMZ, this is terrible. Like, she knew what was happening. It was just all coming apart. She wasn't prepared. She took accountability. She apologized. It happened. I'm not, like, obviously the audience had every right to be disappointed and want their money back even. But that's not where the conversation went. The dialogue went into this very big viral moment of heckling Tiffany Haddish and kind of delighting in her failure and just, you know, I didn't like her anyways and I don't like her and she's too quote-unquote loud and ghetto, and things that I don't really feel like have anything to do with a comedian. Like, comedians don't necessarily have to be likable. They have to be funny. But there's a difference between funny and likable. I mean, most comedians, I hate to, no offense to comedians, but they're not exactly like, you know, likable people. Like, they make fun of everything. So it's sort of interesting to me that in the case of Tiffany Haddish, it was this, you know, 2.5 million people viewing, over 11,000 likes, literally enjoying her getting heckled and failing, talking about how much they don't like her.
Right.
And,
so the viral moment was really accelerated by one video in particular. So if you've missed it somehow, we'll play a little bit of it. This is a man who was in the audience heckling Tiffany Haddish during the performance.
Tiff having a rough night, bro. Tiff having a rough night, bro.
Solid.
Going into 2019 like this.
So, Janae, I think what's so uncomfortable about that is this just joy he seems to take, and he's just reveling in her struggle on stage there.
Yeah, there's a real delight. There's a real delight in the fact that it's happening. And like I said, the response online went viral and people joined in. You know, they don't like her. And it's just a really interesting thing. And it made me think about the fact, why might you not like Tiffany Haddish? So many of them kept saying, quote unquote, she's quote unquote loud and ghetto, which is just problematic in itself. But the idea is Tiffany Haddish is succeeding. She may have failed that night, but she's having the time of her life and her career. And we've seen time and time again when women succeed, you know, when they succeed, it is correlated to not being likable. Like, there's a study that came out in Ohio at Ohio State University that showed women who do really well, who have high GPAs, are less likely to get contacted by employers than males who have those same high GPAs, because a woman with a high GPA is perceived as not likable. So they'd rather a woman who, you know, does okay.
Well, and you wrote about the fact, I mean, Haddish did bomb in the performance, but perhaps the standard is different. And you mentioned that Dave Chappelle had a similarly bad performance, that
he had a lot more
grace, right?
So much more grace, and people kind of laughed along. It became sort of a joke. It's something he even joked about later when he staged his huge comeback and critically acclaimed Netflix specials. It was kind of like a ha-ha, this thing happened in Detroit. And he went back recently and had a great show there. And it's just, there's a grace allowed to men when they make mistakes versus women who, even though he didn't really take accountability. He was just like, yeah, I did it. You're not getting your money back. Ha ha. You know, I feel like she took accountability and it was just no grace. And even if she hadn't, it would have been worse. It's like, there's no win for a woman when she makes a mistake. It's just everything is inflated and it goes right to, why I didn't like you anyways.
All right, I want to try again to bring in Lizzie from Lexington. Lizzie is on the line. What's on your mind, Lizzie?
I think this is an interesting conversation, and I'm happy to be a part of it. But my goal for 2019, as I try to support other women candidates, is to amplify their political message, their talking points, the things that I've heard them say in interviews, their policy points, and get that out there, as well as bringing up the niceness or the likability or the affability when we have this conversation.
Thanks for the call, Lizzie. So, Ellen, to you off of that point, here's someone who's sort of almost making a New Year's resolution, you know, to maybe think about this a little bit differently. I'm curious about how the press should perhaps think about it in 2019. You know, we are already at the start of the 2020 presidential cycle, believe it or not, because Warren was just in Iowa. What are your thoughts upon how press coverage plays into this?
Well, I think that, you know, we're living in a moment where it appears that the American presidency is becoming a reality television show, and that presidential politics and national politics itself are covered so extensively and in such subjective ways by cable news that it's a form of entertainment, infotainment, which I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, the latter, and if it engages voters. But I think what the press can do is to interrogate some of these very questions about how our perceptions of candidates are shaped, and to try to shift the conversation, as your caller suggested, to more substantive matters. And perhaps the Trump presidency will be a corrective on this point. There'll be other women candidates involved as well in this race, it appears. And so the likability question of one versus another may, in this instance, contribute to a broader discussion as well. So I think it's important for the press to be self-conscious and to try to peel back some of these layers, have conversations like this one and others, really looking at the way that voter perceptions are shaped by these two-minute sound bites, by social media, and by fairly superficial responses based on how someone comes across on television.
A recent article in The Atlantic suggested the problem is not discussing likability per se, but doing it without that context, without discussing what may be behind why someone doesn't like a particular candidate, that sexism can play a part of it. And we've seen examples of this, sort of bringing it up absent that context. I'm thinking back to a memorable presidential debate exchange in 2008. This was during the Democratic primary between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama at a debate in New Hampshire. And one of the moderators, Scott Spradling, who was the Channel 9 WMUR anchor, asked this question to Hillary Clinton.
My question to you is simply this. What can you say to the voters of New Hampshire on this stage tonight who see your resume and like it, but are hesitating on the likability issue, where they seem to like Barack Obama more?
Well, that hurts my feelings.
I'm sorry, Senator. I'm sorry.
But I'll try to go on. He's very likable. I agree with that. I don't think I'm that bad.
You're likable enough.
Thank you so much.
So, Ellen, you know, it was that likable enough quip from Barack Obama that caught a lot of attention at the time. But I'm struck listening to that now more than a decade later at the way the moderator's question lacked that framework to say perhaps the likability gap here is colored by sexism.
Well, I think it was an extremely insulting and insensitive question. And I think that Obama's comment was very condescending. And as I listen to it, I'm struck by how honest she was in her response and how human she was in saying, I mean, somebody looks you right in the face and says, how come nobody likes you? I mean, what human being isn't going to feel badly about that? So she responded, I thought, humane in a human fashion to that. But, you know, one would hope that we would be in a political climate in which these would not be the focal points of the discussion. There's so many serious problems in our country today and around the world. We really need answers from our political leaders, and the press should be asking questions that are substantive of these candidates and helping the voters to really focus on what matters.
Let's bring in another caller. Jen is phoning in from Worcester. Jen, how do you see likability show up in your profession?
Well, I'm calling. So I just graduated from law school in May, and so I'm a very new attorney. And I just wanted to comment about how this adds, like, one more problem to the plate of professional women's worries, who we already have so much more mental work. Like, you know, am I wearing too much makeup? Not enough makeup? Is it unprofessional? Are my heels too high to be professional? Are they not high enough, like, that I don't look fancy enough? Or all of this. And now when I hear this discussion, I just wanted to speak to how deeply it affects young women who are developing in this climate and hearing, like, having one more burden put onto our plate that I don't hear being added to men. So thank you for taking my call.
Jen, thanks for the call. Let's go to one more. Caleb in Londonderry. Caleb, we just heard Jen say she doesn't see this likability standard applied to men. What do you see?
Well, I wanted to bring up that I've seen likability. I'm a history teacher, and I bring up charisma and likability in candidates throughout the whole course. For instance, Bill Clinton, when he went on Arsenio Hall and played the saxophone, he was presenting himself as the everyday man. Al Gore, which came across as stoic and boring, lost Bush, the everyday, everyman president, you know, the buddy you can have a beer with, like you were saying earlier. And I think your commentator was correct that it is how we frame things, but it's also been going on for male candidates over a long time as well.
Caleb, thanks for the call. So, Janae, in the moments that we have left, what about that argument from Caleb? You know, that it cuts both ways. You know, likability is a factor for men, too.
I would argue that men get way more grace, and when men get way more cool points, whereas women, like in the case of Warren with the beer, it was a penalty point. It wasn't like, oh, she's cool, let's have a beer with her, look at her, she's just at home with her husband and her dog. It was like, penalty point, you're trying. So whereas, you know, Clinton playing the sax was cool, Clinton going on MTV was cool, but if she strolls out to MTV next, it'll be an issue. It'll be like, oh, you are trying so hard to be the cool girl. And there are penalty points issued for women. And these are things that, like the caller said, professional women deal with this in their offices all the time. A man might be called confident for having a new idea. He will be called innovative and bold for disagreeing with someone. A woman will be called bossy and shrew and emotional. And these are the ways in which we have to think about how things are getting framed and how things are very gendered and how it's absolutely not the same for men.
And we've got almost 2 years to keep having the conversation as we head toward the 2020 election. Janae Osterholt is the culture writer for the Boston Globe. Her latest piece is There's Inequity in How We View Men, Women, and Likeability. Janae, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And our thanks also to Ellen Fitzpatrick. She's a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire and author of The Highest Glass Ceiling, Women's Quest for the American Presidency. Ellen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.